the business desk at State Broadcast News, this is the CRE News Hour. I'm Steve Lubetkin. It's Friday, July 26th, 2019. In this week's edition of the CRE News Hour, we'll go very deep into the tax implications of the Federal Opportunity Zone program with tax lawyer Michael Sanders of Blank Rome. We'll talk to some Chicago brokers about how East Coast money is making its way into projects in the Windy City. We'll learn about an Israeli artificial intelligence company's efforts to help the CRE industry analyze big data. And Kevin Havens of design and delivery firm White & Company will tell us about how Joliet, Illinois redeveloped its downtown with an unusual project as the anchor, a new courthouse and legal complex. We'll be back with this week's news and headlines right after these messages.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Today, you can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. And now let's get started with our roundup of the stories making news in commercial real estate this week. Beauty company Kiss Products has purchased a 470,000-square-foot distribution building for $66 million from the Rockefeller Group and its joint venture partner, PCCP. It's at the Rockefeller Group Logistics Center in Piscataway, New Jersey. The global beauty company will occupy the property this summer, and Kiss expects it'll create more than 250 jobs in Piscataway. Rittenhouse Realty Advisors arranged the $21.4 million sale of a student housing portfolio serving the students of Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. The portfolio includes 44 properties totaling 219 bedrooms, and yes, they're all legally zoned and approved by the city of Bethlehem. Lehigh University's had major expansions planned for the next 10 years, including increasing enrollment and opening a college of health. Eastern Union arranged financing for an $18 million sale of a 600,000-square-foot Magna International portfolio. It's a group of four automobile parts manufacturing facilities in multiple locations in Iowa. Eastern Union delivered loans facilitating the sale of the properties by Toronto-based Granite REIT America to Beaupaire Real Estate of Elmsford, New York. The buyer was facing the imminent expiration of capital gains tax benefits associated with a Section 1031 exchange, and the Eastern Union folks arranged the approval within a fast 3.5-week period. JLL closed a recent sale. It was 19 Chapin Road, a four-building Core Plus light industrial portfolio, totaling about 429,000 square feet in the Morris County community of Montville Township, New Jersey. JLL marketed the property on behalf of a joint venture of Camber Real Estate Partners and Advance Realty Investors. A partnership of Cohen Asset Management and Intercontinental Real Estate Corp. purchased the property. First Washington Realty acquired five properties totaling 800,000 square feet in the Washington, D.C. metro area. The purchase includes Bradley Shopping Center, Shops at Fox Chase, Gateway Overlook, Olney Village Center, and Wheaton Park Shopping Center. Lincoln Property Company says it's finalized entitlements and special permitting for a new life sciences building, 300 3rd Avenue, that's planned for Route 128 in Waltham, Massachusetts. The project's featuring flexible and customized office and laboratory space. It's expected to be completed in 2021. It'll have four stories of laboratory space. And a public-private partnership between real estate developer RBH Group and real estate investment firm Paramount Assets with the city of Newark are bringing mural arts to Newark with a project called Four Corners Public Arts. The initiative's first phase, taking place this fall, will use murals to bring to life more than 20 facades and surfaces in the city's downtown district. A request for mural proposals is open to the public through September 3rd. Artists are invited to propose concepts centered around the histories of these activation sites. You can get more details at fourcornerpublicarts.org. The city of Joliet, Illinois, is staking its downtown redevelopment plans not on retail, condominiums, or office projects. They're staking it on a courthouse. Chicago-based White & Company has designed an open complex for a new courthouse that includes 38 modern courtrooms and a 10-story office tower, enclosing a public space that the city hopes will be the anchor for re-energizing the downtown business district. The White & Company courthouse design has been recognized by the American Institute of Architects Academy of Architecture for Justice. It's one of 15 recipients nationally of the 2018 Justice Facilities Review Awards, and only one of four to win a citation, the highest honor. To get a sense of what's going on with the courthouse in Joliet, we talked with Kevin Havens, who's the executive vice president and director of design at White & Company, about the new courthouse project. Joliet, Illinois, which doesn't get a whole lot of attention.
Right.
There's a new development there. It's costing a lot of money, but it's not a live-work-play. It's a courthouse.
Yes, indeed.
Tell us a little bit about how that happened.
Well, this was an exciting opportunity. The county board of Will County, which resides in Joliet, made a big decision, and that was to not just provide new facilities for the county court establishment, but to actually have it as an opportunity to rethink how development in downtown Joliet might take place. And what's kind of radical about that is typically it's commercial-type projects where, you know, new businesses or residences that are kind of the lead in converting old, tired downtowns. But in this case, they actually had the vision that a civic building might be that down payment, if you will, on changing the entire urban experience. So that was a great challenge to take on as we began the project.
Talk a little bit about the building. It's modern courtrooms, a 10-story tower, and a lot of public space. How is that going to help in the downtown area?
Well, one of the big precepts of the project was we're replacing an adjacent old courthouse from the 1960s. And this building, sadly, was kind of the poster child of everything gone wrong with building design. It's opaque. It has kind of a punitive nature about it. There's really nothing transparent about the interaction of justice. The new courthouse, we were asked by the judiciary to do exactly the opposite. They wanted to have a very transparent expression that justice is there's an equal access to it. It's on display. And to make it a very friendly, inviting place rather than a very cold and off-putting building. So this building actually has been developed vertically. It's 10 stories. It's nearly 370,000 square feet with 38 courtrooms. And what it does is it actually creates a public square in front of the building, kind of sheltered in the L-shaped configuration of the building we've designed. And this is a square that really it's open for anyone to visit. It's heavily landscaped with trees, benches. It's beautifully illuminated in the evening. And it wants to be an attractor for people, not something you want to stay away from. So whether you have court business or not, the urban square is something that they wanted people to be attracted to and therefore be an attractor for businesses and restaurants and shops to start to develop kind of like radiating from the courthouse property. The main lobby to the building is entirely sheathed in glass. It's two stories, and it's kind of counterintuitive for a secure building, which actually it is very secure operationally. You can see inside, and waiting there, whether you're waiting for an elevator to go up to a floor, or you're there as a prospective juror going to the jury assembly area, or if you're conducting business with the court clerk, All these things are very open and on display, if you will. Nothing's really hidden behind closed doors. Even the vertical floors where the courts are stacked, the public waiting area enjoys a beautiful panorama looking north into downtown Joliet, where they can relax and take a breather, decompress a bit before accessing the courtrooms. So this is a different way of thinking about justice, and it was very much based on the community perception of what this new place would be like.
And so how is it going? Is the building up, or when do you project completion?
Well, it's in process. It's topped out at 10 stories now, and they're starting to sheet it with the glass curtain wall and stone materials. And it'll be opened at the end of 2020, open for business. It's projected that they'll have over 3,000 visitors per day. It's a lot, but there's a lot of courtrooms and there's a lot of other agency business to be done there with public defenders, state's attorneys, I mentioned the county court clerk. So there's a lot of all the agencies associated with the court administration area, which are now scattered around downtown Joliet, will coalesce and be in this singular structure.
And that generates a lot of efficiency.
It does indeed, and it also generates a lot of potential business outside of the courthouse. These people need to eat. They need transportation. They might need to access other offices for private attorneys somewhere in the area. So it really becomes kind of an injection of life. At least this is the vision of the county board into this downtown area. So it's quite exciting.
I was going to ask you about the impact on local retail. Is downtown Joliet thriving, or has it been struggling economically?
Well, it's been sputtering. There's been some attempts to get some things going. They have a relatively new public library that's been done. Joliet Junior College has actually opened their culinary institute in the downtown area. So there's kind of some small individual examples of things that have been happening in the downtown to start to spark that return of retail and restaurateurs. The courthouse project is clearly the biggest, and we're hoping that it could be just enough inertia to really get things going. White & Company was actually involved with an unrelated project, which is about two blocks away from the courthouse, that actually has had an immediate effect on the downtown, and that was an expansion to the old historic Joliet Central High School. We put on a few years ago a new student activity center. And a component of that project was an atrium that connected the old historic landmark building to a new dining facility. And kind of the unexpected result of that is that the space now is being rented almost every weekend by one community group after another to hold their events. And it's a splendid thing. A lot of people in Joliet go to high school there, and they really don't move away. They stay in the community. For them to think about that old high school as actually being a magnet for their continued life after graduation is really a marvelous thing. So these little ingredients are doing, in a very stealthy way, I think, the things that traditional development of retail and housing typically does in a downtown. But these cultural institutions, be it education or in this case the civic courthouse, are also doing it from a completely different direction. And it's exciting to see that synergy come together. You know, when the courthouse is completed, there's a vision, and these are not confirmed plans, but the hope is that more consolidation will take place. There might be a new county government center that might even combine with the city government, which right now are two different entities, to actually take the place adjacent to the new courthouse by demolishing the old courthouse. And so it's fun to see at least the intent or the vision to not stop when this is done, but to keep it rolling and to keep injecting this kind of energy into a downtown area.
Kevin Havens is the Executive Vice President and Director of Design for White & Company. He joined us from his office in Chicago. Kevin, thanks very much for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to the CRE News Hour from statebroadcastnews.com. Opportunity Zone investments continue to be one of the most sought-after topics in the commercial real estate world for information, and you're about to get a master's level course in some of the tax issues surrounding Opportunity Zones from Michael Sanders. Michael is Blank Rome's lead partner in the firm's Washington, D.C. office tax group. He focuses his practice in the areas of taxation, offering particular knowledge in matters affecting partnerships, limited liability companies, S corporations, real estate, and estate planning. Michael's a frequent speaker on opportunity fund legislation. He advises fund investors and real estate companies on the program requirements. And in this segment, he provides some up-to-date guidance on some of the tax implications for partnerships planning to invest in opportunity zones. Michael, you are the lead partner for Blank Rome's tax group in the Washington office. And from your perspective, there are a number of open tax issues with respect to opportunity zones. Talk a little bit about what these are and what you think needs to be done to fix these issues.
Thank you very much. There are about four or five, six really important issues that I want to just touch on. First, the question of eligible gains. And the regulations say eligible gains generally are capital gain, which is long and short-term gain. Short-term, it's pretty advantageous because otherwise it would be taxable as ordinary income from actual or deemed sale or exchange, or any other gain that is required to be included in the taxpayer's computation of capital gain. So you need to look at the K-1s you receive from the partnership. And one of the items listed is unrecaptured 1250 gain, which relates to depreciation recapture. And that is not ordinary income, should not be ordinary income, although it's not clear under the regulations. Unrecaptured 1250 gain is taxed at 25% maximum capital gain rate. And so I would take the position that that is an eligible gain for purposes of taking advantage of the Opportunity Zone Fund provisions. Sort of related to that is the Section 1231 issue. Netting is required under this second tranche, netting that is of gains and losses, and the determination of whether you have a net 1231 gain is on the last day of the taxable year. So in effect, it puts the taxpayer in a penalty box. It's a humorous reference, which because you have to wait till the end of the year to be able to take advantage of the Opportunity Zone provisions. And this appears to apply to the partners individually, but not at the partnership level. So a determination may be made on the last day of the taxable year, which would trigger the 180-day period to invest. And by the way, that may impact on the 7-year holding period in 2019, because you're not going to be able, unless you do it on December 31st, to take advantage of that 7-year period of deferral. There's no optionality here. You don't have a choice. So let's say you had a major sale at the partnership level of a shopping center in April of this year. So you would like to reinvest, but according to the regulations, 180 days won't start. You'll have to wait until the netting can take place. You have to receive all your K-1s from other partnerships, as well as your personal 1231 gains. And you might not receive them until next April or May. So reinvestment may be stalled. which is not a good result. And I would expect Treasury to focus on this at some point. The third issue, one that we need to look at today, is the inconsistent treatment of gain after a 10-year period, because it affects how we draft our documents. The real benefit to an equity investor is when they sell their qualified opportunity fund interest directly. So if an investor in a QOF, as taxes a partnership, for example, it makes the fair market value election upon the sale of the QOF interest after 10 years. The effect will be to eliminate any gain upon the investor's sale or exchange of a qualifying investment, regardless of whether the investor has used the losses that had been generated due to depreciation and whether the investor has received leveraged distributions from the QOF during that 10-year period. That's a great result. But under these regulations, the second tranche, if the QOF sells the assets, then in determining as to its allocable share of capital gain, it has to look at Schedule K-1 and make sure that the disposition occurs after the investor's 10-year holding period expires. This election will then only apply to capital gains allocated and not to amounts characterized as ordinary income, such as depreciation recapture of 1245 assets. So there's a difference. And finally, it appears that this election will only apply to gain from dispositions of assets by the QOF itself and won't technically apply to gains recognized by a QOZB, Qualified Opportunity Zone business. And it's unclear as to whether this was intentional, but today that's the result. Another problem. I also would like to take a minute or two to talk about, for planning purposes, the comparison of 1031 treatment to opportunity zone tax benefits. Qualified opportunity zone property investments are not restricted to real estate. They're available to other businesses, hedge funds, for example. Where 1031 is so limited. But 1031 deferral can be permanent because there's a basis step up at death, while opportunity zones allow a permanent step up without the need to die if held for 10 years. So there's a different twist here. There's also the opportunity zone option available for a busted 1031 transaction, which itself would require an hour of discussion. And opportunity zones may do a 1031 rollover itself during the 10-year period, but the technical substantial improvement test would likely need to be satisfied based upon the property that's purchased. Why don't I take a few minutes and talk about the advantages of leasing properties, which ultimately can benefit related parties. The leased tangible property must be acquired under a lease after December 31st, 2017. So it's a new lease. The leased property does not need to meet that original use test or substantial improvement requirements, but must be a market rate lease. As to a related party, which can now be treated favorably under these rules, which is a big step. No prepayments are allowed for more than a 12-month period. Also, it's important to examine the terms of the lease. If the term of the lease is too long in that it exceeds the useful life of the building, it may be considered a purchase under the tax rules, thereby triggering this substantial improvement requirement in order to be a QOZP, or treat it as a sale between related parties and fail as to those assets, be an issue under the 70% test, the substantial test. But keep in mind, the longer the term of the lease, the greater the value of the property, which we focus on the potential appreciation, which would be excluded from tax after the 10-year hold. Anyhow, it's important that improvements made by the lessee to the leased tangible property should satisfy the original use test, be favorable for purposes of the 70% test. The improvements will revert to the fee lessor at the end of the lease term. Active business. Talk about the triple net lease and land banking limitation. The regulations provide that leasing real property used in a trade or business is treated as the active conduct of a trade or business, but stipulate that merely entering into a triple net lease is not considered an active trade or business. And this is potentially a problem because many industrial leases are triple net. So you need leasing activity that rises above what is merely a triple net lease. You need advertising, management, operation. In the new market tax credit area, there are favorable rules on generating gross income within 3 years, but we don't have that here. So, you're going to meaningfully participate. There's some good language in the Go Zone area notice 2006-77, which should be helpful here. As to the treatment of unimproved vacant land, well, let me just say the timing generally regarding original use turns on when depreciation begins, when first placed in service. One of the concerns in the regulations is it requires an asset-by-asset determination as to substantial improvement, not on an aggregate basis at this point, which can create problems. But there is a favorable language that property that's unused for an uninterrupted period, say 5 years, will be considered original use when acquired by the QOF or the QOZB, which is really favorable. But you got to focus on land banking because that's a potential abuse. I mean, they don't want property to be acquired and accumulated and held for development down the road. So if the land is acquired with the expectation, intention, or view not to improve by more than an insubstantial amount within 30 months, there'll be a problem. And they have not defined insubstantial. Another area I want to touch on is the QOZB advantages of a two-tier structure and taking advantage of the working capital safe harbor. It may be advantageous for the QOF, instead of investing in property itself, to invest through a second-tier QOZB subsidiary, which may not be a disregarded entity. And in that regard, they can get the benefit of a 63% qualifying asset rule as compared to the 90% QOF tier. And they can take advantage of the 31-month safe harbor, which is very attractive. And now it's been expanded under these regulations to include the development of a trade or business in a qualified opportunity zone, as well as the acquisition, construction, and or substantial improvement of tangible property. It'll cover payroll, inventory, occupancy, and so on. Secondly, exceeding the 31-month rule does not violate safe harbor if the delay is attributable to waiting for government action, which is not completed within the 31-month period. And the regulations also provide clarity that a business may benefit from multiple overlapping or sequential applications of the working capital safe harbor. So those are key issues that I see, and I just wanted to summarize them for you.
Michael, what's your sense about the open tax issues? Are they going to be resolved by Treasury or the IRS, or how does that mechanism work, and what do you think the outcome is going to be?
Well, I don't expect that we're going to see a third tranche of regulations. I think Treasury has already indicated that. And it may be that after hearings and the receipt of comments, that they finalize all of them at the same time. Now, hopefully, they'll clean up a lot of these issues. It's interesting to me that every time they publish, what we see are more issues raised. And as I've said a number of times at these tax conferences, the brighter, the more knowledgeable the tax lawyer is, the more issues they see and create. And so that's potentially a problem for the, let's say, the developer, the businessman, the private equity fund. They want answers so they can make some decisions and invest. And it's slowing down because of this very issue.
So what's the best advice that you're giving your clients about positioning themselves to be on the right side of the regulations as they exist today?
What I'm advising clients is you can't wait for absolute clarity. I feel that if you're in good faith, and there will be anti-abuse rules at some point, but if you're in good faith and don't try to game the system, you can move forward and don't wait, because it's critical to acquire the properties or essentially move the businesses sooner rather than later. You want to take advantage of those attractive properties located in designated zones. So if you're going to wait for perfection, you may never get there, because the competition is going to beat you. So you got to be willing to step forward. And you also, there's an advantage at this point to do it in 2019 to get the full 7-year deferral.
Michael Sanders is the partner in charge of the taxation group at Blank Rome's law offices in Washington, D.C. Michael, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a minute.
Shalom. This is Rabbi Richard Address. Join us for our podcast series from Jewish Sacred Aging entitled Seekers of Meaning. We'll explore some of the issues and events that impact ourselves, our families, and our Jewish world at large in light of the current revolution in aging.
The Seekers of Meaning podcast airs every Friday morning at 8 a.m. at JewishSacredAging.com. Today, you can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. U.S. apartment building sales reached a record high last year, according to a recent report from Jones Lang LaSalle. In Chicago, the properties trading hands aren't just located downtown. Some of the hottest markets for multifamily sales are Southside neighborhoods like Washington Park, South Shore, and Hyde Park, according to Chicago-based Interra Realty. Driving some of the demand is what Interra calls coastal cash. That's East Coast investors who are snapping up value-add properties with cap rates that are in some cases double what they'd find in the New York area. We wanted to find out more about this, so we got on the phone with John Morgan and David Goss, the co-founders and partners in Interra, to talk about what's going on in Chicago in terms of the East Coast investment. So one of the things that you're seeing seems to be this phenomenon you're calling coastal cash, money from East Coast investors who are looking at value-add properties in Chicago that offer them maybe a better opportunity than what they might find in the New York area. Tell us a little bit about what's going on.
The phenomenon we've kind of seen over the last 24 months has, you know, really been a change in our local markets where most of the local buyers have been getting priced out, whether it's, you know, East Coast money, West Coast money, frankly, out of the country, money and investors have started flooding the Chicagoland market. And we've seen it kind of across all geographic locations in and around our marketplace. So I would say in the last 18 months, specifically, I mean, we have had competitive parties bidding against each other, all frankly out of state. Investors that haven't previously transacted in the Chicagoland area. And, you know, I think we don't see that continuing to slow anytime soon. And it's really just been about chasing a yield that they're not otherwise able to achieve in their current marketplace.
So what are we talking about? The indications are you're talking about cap rates that are double what they might get in New York.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, that's really been it. I mean, essentially what we continue to hear from them is, you know, the economics and the demographics to the markets within, call it Brooklyn, Bronx, you know, all of those markets, there's similar demographics and economics within the Chicagoland area. But it's truly that. I mean, they're buying at a cap rate that is materially above what they can achieve in their local markets today. So it's really driven cash both from the lenders and from investors into our marketplace that are otherwise out of state.
What are some of the factors that make Chicago, first of all, attractive to these investors besides the cap rates? And secondly, what are some of the things that you're telling people to look for when they go into this market?
I think one of the big drivers has been, you know, there's been some early on money, again, coming in from New York specifically, that, you know, they start chatting, they start talking about what it's like to operate an apartment building. It's no different than what they experienced 10, 15 years ago in their marketplace. So as they start to hear that from other local investors within New York, they start to chase. We had an assignment that we were selling, and we had two New York families that kind of had crossed paths. Once one party saw that the other, who they ran across each other's path in their own marketplace, they started to want to, you know, immediately try to get their offer and first try to lock down the property. And I think a lot of that has just been, you know, it's been driven by they're priced out of their market. You know, there's just, it's gotten so competitive within their space that, you know, there is no necessary return. They're only gaining appreciation in that marketplace. Whereas here, you know, you can still achieve some cash flow and you've got appreciation in our marketplace still. So I think those two line up to where investors are looking to come here rather than solely buying on an appreciation basis within their marketplace today.
One of the things we're seeing a lot of, there's almost a herd mentality. It's, you know, pushed a little bit by proper marketing, but like John said, the last building we were selling was 238 units. We had several families from New York, and they, you know, it's just like anything else, one hears it and they all start following. So it's kind of like a train, And, you know, we particular listing that we, John was talking about, we have San Francisco buyer, we have several New York buyers. They just kind of follow each other.
Israeli. We had an couple groups out of Israel.
Right. And I think one of the things you would ask, John, like what one of the things that is bringing people to Chicago is, I mean, you hear all the negative stuff on the news, but it's almost secondary because everybody, that's in every city. But one thing Chicago has that a lot of other cities don't have is a huge migration of younger people in. We are losing some population of like the older people, but they're the professionals, the young people with a lot of money. There's so many people moving in, and whether it's so, just it churns people. So the new people are coming in for the A credit, the A stuff, and the center city, and it pushes everybody out. So there's just an increased demand for apartments all about the city.
It's very similar to what we saw within the last year, you know, New York people pushing further west into New Jersey, and now it seems like they're pushing really far west with what you're saying.
Yeah, correct. So we only correct. See, you know, in the city is just getting filled and filled. You know, the suburbs may be suffering somewhat, but, you know, everybody just shifts over. It's a constant stream of gentrification moving. So everything, but everything, even the bottom is being lifted up. So there, we don't really have as many like just seriously distressed neighborhoods as we used to, because there's a lot of money going in there to fix them up. So it's actually a benefit to the city as a whole.
Yeah. And again, most of the neighborhoods where we're seeing this money come into, they're just outside of the central business district. So, I mean, the reality of it, you know, you're coming from out of state, but your proximity, as you look at kind of where tenants want to live, they want to live in an affordable area just outside of the CBD, you know, that's within driving distance of 10, 15 minutes or less. And I think that's really where we've seen the focus. And, you know, obviously as Chicago continues to grow, maybe not at the pace of a New York, it's still going to grow over time.
So given the fact that there's all this interest now, how long do you think it's going to be before things sort of calm down, or is it got a ways to go to run itself out yet?
I think we have quite a ways to go. I mean, if you look at kind of where we are, what previously had happened with relation to banks and lending, you know, you're not seeing crazy lending. People are coming in with real money down, real equity at the table, not structured finance that otherwise caused over leverage. Those aren't occurring in the current cycle. So based on what we're seeing, you know, there's an abundance of senior debt in the marketplace. What we're starting to see both locally and nationally is all of the banks are actually even taking the term of their you know, loans out. So like a traditional local lender might have done 3 or 5 year money. Now those same lenders are offering 5 to 10 year money, which previously you had to go to Fannie, Freddie, and other agencies to get. But now it's available on a local bank basis. So to me, by that occurring in itself, that stretches out the duration of this next cycle. I think we have several years of runway left before you start to see, you know, frankly, even a flattening of the market. And then, you know, I think we're well away from any potential crash in a market cycle.
So some economists are seeing a bit of a slowdown across the overall economy over the next year or so. Do you have any sense of whether your market is going to slow down, or what are the things that concern you that you're keeping an eye on about the possibility of a slowdown?
One of the things that we always look at first is absorption. I think in the Chicagoland market, you know, absorption really hasn't played an impact on the more neighborhood areas where we do a lot of our brokerage. I think there's, you know, there's concerns over oversupply of Class A kind of directly in the CBD. But at the same time, I mean, that product has been getting absorbed. So, you know, concessions are still at record lows in the Chicagoland area. We haven't started to see a whole lot of creep there as of yet. And I think the reality of it is, you know, these tertiary areas outside of the CBD, I mean, ultimately, the vacancies are extremely low. The rents are still affordable, and there's still the ability to get rent growth. So I think a lot of those have lined up to where the concerns haven't really been there in our space as of yet. And I usually see that first in the lending markets. We have seen very aggressive senior debt at this point that has continued to keep kind of our industry moving at a good pace from a value standpoint.
John Morgan and David Goss are the founders and principals of Interra Realty in Chicago. They joined us from their car somewhere on a freeway in the Windy City. John and David, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate your perspectives on the market.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for the time. Appreciate it. Thanks.
You're listening to the CRE NewsHour. I'm Steve Lubetkin. Artificial intelligence is starting to move into the commercial real estate industry, and one of the leaders in the field is an Israeli company called Okapi, spelled O-K-A-P-I. Okapi has a machine learning platform that helps major landlords, think 25-plus million square foot portfolios, improve their net operating income by analyzing massive, diverse sets of data and identifying operational improvements that generate revenue, bolster leasing activity, improve the tenant experience, and reduce costs. Okapi is an Israeli company, and we spoke with Maya Gal, who's a co-founder and chief revenue officer of the company. She and her partner, Iris Sidon, have expanded the company's work in the real estate industry into Canada and the U.S. Maya, thanks for joining us on the CRE NewsHour.
Hi, very happy to be here.
So tell us a little bit about how you got started with Okapi. You've got an artificial intelligence platform that has the potential to help landlords improve their operating income and their overall tenant experience by looking at big data. How did you get started and how did you move into commercial real estate with it?
Actually, Iris and I co-founded Okapi. Our background was in business intelligence. We worked in that sphere for many, many years, bringing visualization of existing data. And we found that there is a very big lag in the way that current tools work today. They allow you to see what happened in the past, but they don't support proactive actions. And there's really a very big abyss of data where organizations accumulate a large amounts of data on a daily basis. While we're speaking right now, data has been accumulated and created, but most of that data is just being thrown away. It's rotting away in some warehouse or in some files, and it's not being put to good use. And seeing that gap, we thought, what is the value that Okapi can bring to the world? And we actually started implementing Okapi in manufacturing, in the manufacturing area where there's a lot of data. Data coming in from sensors from machines, data coming in from sensors from a lot of different parameters in the manufacturing and data existing in IT systems. And we had a lot of success there. And we started to think what other applications this could have. And we came across the CRE business. That was about 3 years ago. And we fell in love with it. There's a huge problem of data. Lots of data exists. Landlords store a lot of data, but they don't use it in order to create proactive notifications. And our first customer, Quadreal, which we met, kind of explained to us that manufacturing and real estate are not that different. There's a large operation. There's a lot of data. A lot of people in the field making day-to-day decisions without any support of any systems. And during that application, that first application, we saw a great fit, and we've been enjoying a great success ever since.
So how does it work with real estate data? What kinds of inputs are you using, and what kinds of analysis do you deliver to clients, and how does that help them?
Well, a lot of organizations, as I said, collect data. The data could either be data coming in from business systems like MRI, VTS, Yardi, Angus, lots of different IT systems. Data could be coming in from sensors. It could be HVAC sensors, occupancy sensors, different types of sensors in the building. And data could even be external data. It could be weather data. It could be market data, location-based data. There are a lot of types of data sources that can help landlords understand how they can improve their NOI. And Okapi is able to connect to those data sources, run very complex algorithms in the back end, and then in the front end create simple notifications that are sent to asset management groups, property management groups, engineering teams, with proactive notifications that and insights that let them know how they can improve the bottom line.
So, for example, if you're gathering data from HVAC sensors, building monitoring, are the algorithms already built, or do you have to customize them for each client?
So in Okapi's algorithms are already pre-developed. We have a very strong engine that knows how to connect to different types of sources. That data could be leasing data in VTS. It could be work order system data in Angus or Yardi. It could be financial data, or it could be sensor data. We are agnostic of the system. Our algorithms are able to run through that data and find hidden improvements in real time and create those into notifications. The algorithms look for anomalies in the data. They look for root causes for problems. They look for predictions. And they really help uncover what is the next best action that I can take. In order for this not to be like a very theoretical statement, I can give some examples so it will become more practical.
Yeah, please.
So some of our customers are looking for a way to increase income from their existing assets. They have a lot of different tenants, and they want to understand what are the opportunities for them to get to increase the income from those tenants. So Okapi might be running through the different systems and find, for example, a potential to offer a larger space for a tenant due to higher occupancy. It could be found from understanding the number of people that actually walk through the carousel every morning. And could be understood from external data that could be collected about that tenant, or even from sensor data that we have, or from work order system data. So it doesn't really matter what type of sources you have. Okapi is able to plug into them and find in that data an opportunity to increase the income. And another example might be finding an anomaly in the way that your tenants buy parking from you. And find offers or places where you can offer your tenants more parking spaces. So there is a lot of hidden opportunities inside the data to increase the income. What Okapi does is it crunches very large data sets that already exist, that you already have, and creates those notifications in plain text for people who are not data scientists but need to know what they need to do right now.
So in the commercial real estate sector, you launched initially in Canada and you're now moving into the U.S. What kinds of feedback are you hearing from commercial real estate clients or prospective clients in the U.S. about using the service?
Well, as you said, when we started in Canada, we actually started with some large landlords that have portfolios both in Canada and in the States. So we're not brand new to the States, working with customers like Oxford Properties or Bentall Green Oak, who have presence in both Canada and the United States. Currently, starting our work here in New York, we're focused on finding the large landlords who can value from Okapi. We already have a few of them that we've started piloting our platform, and we're getting great feedback for the value that the system can bring. Because I think there's a lot of noise in the prop tech scene. There's a lot of startups out there, but most of them are focused either on the investment side or on solving very specific questions that landlords have. Do I use my energy to the best possible way? That is a siloed solution. But there are not a lot of solutions, or we haven't run into solutions that are focused on how do I do improvement of the NOI across the board? How do I operate my buildings better and increase the tenant experience while increasing the income and reducing the costs? So in that sphere, in that area, we're getting a good feedback that we're very unique.
Now, in the output that you deliver to clients, is it in the form of a dashboard or is it a report? How do they look at the analysis that you provide?
That's a great question. Our customers are the frontline employees. They're not people sitting behind a desk and analyzing data. There are people who are running asset management teams, people running property management buildings, people giving the day-to-day service. So these people are on the ground. They will consume Okapi notifications, even through a mobile app. They will click, they will gling and say, you have a new notification. They will open up that notification and they will receive something that they need to do right now that will help them know more about the tenant, about the team, about a specific asset that is on the ground that they can improve. So most of our customers use Okapi through the mobile app. There is, of course, a web version where I can see accumulation of all the notifications I received and trends over time and other things like that. But Okapi is really meant to be a real-time solution acquired, used by people as they're doing their day-to-day job.
Maya Gall is the co-founder and chief revenue officer of Okapi. You can get more information at their website, okapi.ai. Maya, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for hosting.
And that'll wrap things up for this edition of the CRE News Hour. You can send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas to Steve at statebroadcastnews.com, or you can leave an audio comment for us using the voicemail icon on the homepage at statebroadcastnews.com. And we tape this program in Studio A at State Broadcast News in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Join us again for the next episode of the CRE News Hour next Friday at 8 a.m. Eastern Time at statebroadcastnews.com or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Steve Lubetkin. We'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.